Today's episode of the Prosecutor's Podcast is brought to you by Progressive. Progressive helps you get a great rate on car insurance, even if it's not with them. They have this nifty comparison tool that puts rates side by side so you choose a rate and coverages that work for you. So let's say you're interested in lowering your rate on your car insurance. Visit Progressive.com to get a quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see the rate from Progressive, and then their tool will provide options from other companies, all lined up and easy to compare, so that all you have to do is choose the rate and coverages you like. Progressive gives you options so you can make the best choice for you.
You could be looking forward to saving money in the very near future. More money for, say, a pair of noise-canceling headphones, an Instapot, more puzzles, whatever brings you joy. Get a quote today at Progressive.com. It's one small step you can do today that could make a big impact on your budget tomorrow. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Prosecutors. Today on the Prosecutors, we are closing in on the conclusion into our investigation into the death of JonBenet Ramsey. Everybody, and welcome to this episode of The Prosecutors. I'm Brett, and I'm joined, as always, with my spiffing co-host, Alice.
Hi, Brett. Spiffing. That's so...
Spiffing.
I haven't heard that in a very long time. At first, I thought...
I've never heard it.
I thought you were going to go with spiffy,
really know what it means.
Like the 90s term, like spiffy.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's
you
a little childish. But spiffing, like a whole new...
Spiffing.
You know... The twist you're putting on it.
Do you know what spiffing means?
No, not at all.
Neither do I.
Well, I'm looking it up right now.
Apparently, it's British, and I think it's a good thing. So we're going with it. You are spiffing.
I love it. We should bring it to America.
There you go.
You're spiffing yourself. Well, that sounds...
Everybody needs to call their friends spiffing today.
Maybe we should leave it to the British to tell us how to use it.
Maybe. Since we don't know how to use it, we'll just move on.
We tried.
Yeah. We didn't really, you know, we do research on most things, but not always what we're calling Alice on a daily basis. So I just trust you guys when you tell me that it's a good thing and it means a good thing. I just go with it. So, you know, you could have me calling Alice any number of things and I would just walk right into it. So I'm trusting you guys.
What Brett just said is he researches everything to a T in his life except for the most important part of the job, which is describing me. Feels
great.
See,
I was going to go with the least important, but I see what you're saying. Apparently, spiffing means stylish and attractive. So there you go, Alice. There you go.
Very stylish. See?
Very stylish. Most stylish co-host in podcasting today. I guess I should stop talking because we're 8 episodes into this. This is our 8th episode. So we really need to kind of move it along if we're ever going to talk about anything other than JonBenet Ramsey. I feel like we've covered a lot of really interesting things, though, and we have more interesting things for you today. So let's just go ahead, leave spiffing behind, and dive into the rest of the story. And the thing we're going to talk about today, or where we're going to start, are some of the detectives who worked on this case.
Absolutely. You know, Brett, every time I think we've talked about all the aspects of the case, will stop recording. And I'm like, oh, we have to talk about this next time. And this is one of those aspects. As we've talked about, there are two detectives most often associated with this case. The first is Steve Thomas, who wrote a best-selling book that we've discussed a lot throughout these episodes. And it's about his investigation and who he believes the Ramseys are responsible for the death of JonBenet. The other is Lou Smith, a retired homicide detective who believed an intruder was responsible for her death. Both have their flaws. Steve Thomas had never investigated a homicide before. That did not make him unusual in Boulder. As we've noted, the city had maybe one homicide a year, and most of those were pretty straightforward, not something as complicated as JonBenet's murder. Thomas had cut his teeth doing undercover investigations in narcotics. He was a good cop and certainly not a novice, but he had never faced something like this before. And it's clear that Thomas's investigation was thorough, at least on the things he cared about. But when it came to investigating suspects other than the Ramseys, he constantly balks.
And I think those of you who've read Thomas's book, if you read it closely, you will see this. There is Thomas, he's very clearly a good cop, and he makes a lot of really good points. It's a good book. I enjoyed the book quite a bit, but there's a lot of bias there. And, you know, one thing Thomas is constantly doing is he's constantly sort of explaining why they didn't solve the case or why they didn't get an arrest. And some of that is perfectly legitimate. I mean, he spares no punches when it comes to the investigation by the Boulder police and all the things we've talked about and all those shortcomings. He does not try and cover those up. But there's also a feeling of it's not his fault. Like, it's not my fault that nobody was ever arrested. And he constantly says things like, we had probable cause to make an arrest. Why weren't we making arrests? There was all this evidence against Patsy, who he believes is responsible for this. But the thing that is frustrating about the book is he never just comes out and says what all this evidence is. It's a long book. It'll take you a while to read it. And over the course of the book, at various times, he tells you various things that makes him think Patsy is responsible. But you kind of have to string it together yourself. There's never a moment where he sort of builds the case. And that's the one thing I was really disappointed in, because I kept waiting. I wanted to hear it. I wanted to hear him make the case against Patsy Ramsey, and he didn't do that. And then there are other times where he does things that are just infuriating, especially as a prosecutor, because oftentimes we are called upon to ask police officers to go out into the field and gather evidence, and particularly on areas where we think the case is weak. And every time the Boulder DA, who had plenty of flaws, many, many flaws, which are also evident from the book, but whenever they would ask perfectly reasonable things of Thomas, he would scoff at them and complain about them and act as if they were impossible. For instance, the Boulder DA wanted the police to find every person who had been at the parties that the Ramseys had attended, both the one at their home and the one at Fleet White's home. Interview all those people and figure out where they were the night of the murder, which is not a big ask. I know that's going to be 100 people probably, and that's a lot of interviews to do, and that's a lot of work, but that is a perfectly reasonable thing to ask when you are trying to narrow down suspects. Another thing he does is whenever other officers are doing their work, he's constantly criticizing them. So a good example of this, we talked about Santa Claus, Bill McReynolds, last time. At some point, the Boulder police officers go out to his house to get a sample of rope that they believe might be consistent with the cord that was used in the garrote. And they go up there and they test it, and it's not a match. And in his book, he talks about how embarrassing this was for them, that they had gone out there and done this and bothered this poor man. And all I'm thinking is, no, that's good police work. Like, you just eliminated a suspect, or at least eliminated one angle on a suspect. But for him, unless it's focused on the Ramseys, he views it as a waste of time. And that kind of tunnel vision is really problematic.
Yeah, Brett, that's such a good point. When we hit dead ends in our investigation, we don't get disappointed. It's actually a very necessary checkbox, right? And if someone who I think is the most likely suspect is definitively ruled out because of an investigation step, I breathe a sigh of relief because as the prosecutor, I just stepped away from potentially charging the wrong person. And so to me, while I may be disappointed, like, gosh, I really thought it was this person, and I can definitively rule them out because of, you know, security camera footage, DNA, whatever, I actually breathe a sigh of relief because I'm like, thank goodness, this would have been so much worse if I'd indicted the person, you know, really completely changed their lives forever, put them through a lot, and then realize after the fact I made a mistake.
And look, that happens all the time. I mean, you guys would be surprised how often you'll be in the middle of an investigation and you've got evidence in front of you and you're sort of building the narrative in your head because you're always looking for the story. Like, what is the story of the case? And what is the role that the various players had? And sometimes you're at a point where you've got your evidence and you're looking at the story and a certain story starts to form. And then you'll do one more interview or you'll look at one more thing and suddenly it shifts everything. And maybe it doesn't change the story entirely, but it certainly might eliminate somebody who you thought was a bad guy, you thought was a suspect, you thought was a potential target, and suddenly you realize they're not because of that one piece of information. And if you hadn't gotten that information, you might have indicted the wrong person because you had good evidence to support it, but now you have more evidence and you have a better picture and a better understanding of the case. And I struggled with why Thomas was so, because if he's right, I mean, just imagine he's right. Imagine it is Patsy. How valuable would it be if all these people that people constantly go back to as a potential suspect, if he could have definitively removed those people? And the only way to do that is to look into them, to investigate them, to check out their alibis, to see whether or not they have a stun gun or whether or not they have the cord that matches or whatever. That's the only way to do it, to talk to every single person at those parties, figure out where they were. You know, you eliminate all those people, suddenly that telephone call, the 911 call that happened on that one party that we talked about in episode one, some people think that was a test. Some people think that was the person who was responsible calling 911 to see how long it took the police to respond. I don't think that's the case, but there are people who do. You know how we could have eliminated that? If we identified every single person at the party and figured out that all of them had rock-solid alibis, then we would know for sure that the 911 call was irrelevant. But unless you do that investigation, you're never going to be able to say.
Right, Brett. And look, we're not – a lot – all of us are guilty wanting confirmation bias to some degree, but that's what we have to check each other all the time. So the fact that he gets so upset when, you know, or he doesn't want to investigate leads because he thinks it's a waste of time, I don't think it's because he only wants to pin it on the Ramseys. I think it's because he thinks he's so sure of the result that he doesn't want to waste time on other things. And the reality is it's not a waste of time.
Alice, we've got a very different kind of sponsor for this episode, the Jordan Harbinger Show, a podcast you should definitely check out since you're a fan of high-quality, fascinating podcasts hosted by interesting people. The show covers such a wide range of topics through weekly interviews with heavy-hitting guests, and there are a ton of episodes you'll find interesting since you're a fan of this show. I'd recommend our listeners check out an interview with Sammy the Bull Gravano. If you're interested in the mob like I am, you will enjoy that one, I guarantee it. Or if you want to know if you're a psychopath and you want something a little bit more scientific than our riddle, check out the Are You a Psychopath episode.
There's an episode for everyone, though, no matter what you're into. The show covers stories like how a professional art forger somehow made millions of dollars while being chased by the feds and the mafia. Jordan's also done an episode all about birth control and how it can alter the partners we pick and how going on or off the pill can change elements of our personalities. The podcast covers a lot, but one constant is Jordan's ability to pull useful pieces of advice from his guests. I promise you, you'll find something useful that you can apply to your own life, whether that's an actionable routine change that boosts your productivity or just a slight mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. We really enjoyed the show, and we think you will as well. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. This episode is brought to you by Surfshark. This video is not available in your location. Does that sound familiar? If it does, then let me tell you why a VPN is the solution to your problems. A VPN doesn't only increase online privacy, which you need, trust me, and helps you avoid hackers. It also helps you access entertainment because the content you see is limited by your geographic location. But if you use a VPN, you can change your virtual location and forget about restrictions and censorship.
You know, Alice, we all have all these different streaming services we're paying for, and you need to get your money's worth. If you can't find what to watch on Netflix, Hulu, Disney Plus, or some other streaming platform, unlock new libraries with a VPN. Can't watch a YouTube video? Connect to a different location with a VPN. Can't access certain websites or apps through school or office networks? Try a VPN. So try Surfshark risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/prosecute. Enter promo code PROSECUTE for 83% off and 3 extra months free. You heard me right, 3 extra months for free. That's surfshark.deals/prosecute. And let me just say this. It's not because he's lazy. He is not a lazy officer. He is not somebody who's looking to cut corners. We've talked about the Routier case a lot, and there is another similarity in that the Boulder Police Department set up surveillance on JonBenet's grave. And Steve Thomas goes out to Georgia and spends days watching her graveside from a blind. They had gone to the hardware store and fashioned a tombstone out of a piece of wood that they then put a microphone in so that they could listen to anybody who came to the graveside, for the same reason that the Texas police listened to Darlie Routier's, the graveside of her kids, thinking somebody might come, you know, Patsy might show up and confess to the crime at the graveside. And he spent days there. So he was committed to this. He spent a ton of time on it. He built this massive book of all the evidence in the case and this massive affidavit about why he thought the Ramseys might be involved. But that was his white whale. I mean, he was so focused on the Ramseys, and maybe for good reason. Maybe they're responsible, and he knew it, but the negative effects of that tunnel vision are so evident in this case, and it goes beyond just Thomas. There's also the problem with his interactions with the DA's office. You cannot have an investigation that's going to be successful if the DA's office and the police department hate each other, if they disagree on everything. And that's what you had here. And you had a DA's office that did not like to go to trial. They were used to solving most of their problems through plea deals. They did not look forward to taking on the best lawyers in the country in court without a rock-solid case. And Thomas doesn't seem to recognize that. He seems to think, look, we got probable cause. We can get through a grand jury. We can get an indictment. Let's just do that and then roll our dice at trial. And that's not what you do. And that's not what any DA's office wants to do. And it certainly wasn't what the Boulder DA's office wanted to do. And they kept asking them, we need more. We need something else. We need something definitive that ties the Ramseys to the death of JonBenet. And Thomas either couldn't or wouldn't give it to them. And that is just the ultimate frustration in his book, and really, I think, in the investigation as a whole.
And the other detective is Lou Smith. Lou Smith, on the other hand, had investigated dozens of difficult murder cases. He may have had a blind spot. In his most famous case, he proved that parents suspected of killing their child were innocent and that indeed an intruder was responsible. Maybe Lou was trying to catch lightning in a bottle twice and lost his objectivity along the way. Moreover, Smith joined the Ramsey team relatively early in the investigation. From that point forward, he would not have access to the police files in the way that Thomas would.
Yeah, and Smith, he's kind of the opposite of Thomas. There's like a yin and a yang. And Thomas respected Smith a lot, and that comes through in the book, but they disagreed completely on the case. Smith was convinced this was an intruder that did this. Thomas obviously thought it was someone in the family. Smith does a lot of good work, and some of the observations he made are interesting. And I think sometimes people get lost in the fact that he was on sort of Team Ramsey. Yes, that is a bias for him. He thinks they're innocent. And you have to remember that. You have to keep it in the back of your mind at all times. But it doesn't mean that everything he says is irrelevant. And one of the things about this case, everyone in this case has some sort of bias. There aren't a whole lot of sort of independent entities looking at this. So, you know, people who are in favor of the Ramseys doing it will tell you that John Douglas, the FBI profiler, who we've talked about his book, The Cases That Haunt Us, and what he wrote in that book about this case. He worked for the Ramseys, and so people will say, well, he's biased because he was paid by the Ramseys. Maybe it was, but then those same people will look at the CBS documentary and the work that was done on that and act like that was all an independent investigation, as if they went into that to conduct an independent investigation when they didn't. They went into it to present this theory that Burke was responsible. And so the people who were on that show, the experts who were on that show, the reason they were on it is because either their theories were going to explicitly say that Burke Ramsey was responsible, or sort of the more implicit, it's possible, right? So you end up having these recreations designed to show that it's possible a 9-year-old could maybe do this kind of damage to a human skull, as if that proves anything. And they're not scientific recreations. They're just recreations designed to prove a point. In much the same way, you guys remember we talked about Scott Peterson. They did the recreation with the boat. And the whole point of the recreation with the boat was to show that there's no way you could throw a body off the boat into the water without sinking the boat. And so they take the boat out there, and they do this whole dramatic thing where the guy's trying to dump the body over the side, and water's pouring into the boat, and he's about to drown, and all this other stuff. And that was never allowed into court because it's not scientific. They didn't even use the same kind of boat. It's obvious that the whole point of this was to show that, not to actually demonstrate what would happen, but to reach a conclusion. And you see the same thing in the CBS documentary. And you just have to remember, everybody who's coming at this, from Scott Thomas to the people involved in that documentary to John Douglas, yeah, they do have an angle. And the best you can do is listen to what they say, see if it makes sense, see if it fits with the evidence, and move forward. There's not going to be an unbiased voice in this case. One person I want to briefly mention and then not spend any more time on is John Mark Carr. Those of you who follow this case may remember that in the mid-2000s, John Mark Carr came forward and claimed that he was responsible for the death of JonBenet Ramsey. Carr was a known pedophile. I think at the time he was in Thailand, which many people who are pedophiles will often travel to those areas because the laws there are more, well, it's not that the laws are necessarily more lax when it comes to this stuff, but enforcement of the laws certainly are. And so in the United States, you'll often have prosecutions of people who travel internationally for the purpose of engaging in illegal sexual activity with children. Carr was one of those people. He'd been arrested for that. He was on his way back to the United States, and suddenly he drops this bombshell about how he was responsible for JonBenet Ramsey's death. This was huge news for about a couple days. And then the story completely fell apart. Carr, his story didn't really match anything. the DNA that we do have, which is not that much, did not match him. And when you compared what he was saying to what the police knew, his story completely fell apart. And so he is just another example of a phenomenon we have talked about before, where people who are not responsible for a crime will claim that they are. And we often express sort of disbelief that anyone would ever do that. I think with Carr, it's a little different maybe than in a lot of cases. I think Carr saw this, it was a fantasy for him. I mean, it's a sick, right? But this is the kind of person he was. If he could have been involved in that crime, he would have wanted to be. For the notoriety of being the person who had murdered JonBenet Ramsey, and so he attempted to sort of steal that quote-unquote glory for himself, but was eventually proven to be a liar.
Yeah, this is a really interesting phenomenon. There are more and more media outlets who recognize this kind of perverted desire to be famous for something just horrendous, right? We see this with mass shooters. A lot of media outlets now recognize that they shouldn't really use the mass shooter's name, because that's kind of what the mass shooter wants, is for their name to be on every, you know, tongue in America. And those who aspire to be like that mass shooter, to have that notoriety, will listen and see how often that person's name is used in print, on media, in podcasts, and, you know, what have you, all around. And they think, if I do something like that, I can be as famous. This is kind of like the inverse of that, where the horrendous act has already happened. And since no one has been given credit for it, Carr is like, this is how I'll be famous. This is how I will get my fame. And I mean, that's not something I want to be known for, but there are certainly a number of people out there who would like to be known for this type of horrendous act. Brett, I gotta tell you, there is no one-size-fits-all solution when it comes to hair care. A product that works wonders for curls might make straight hair limp and greasy. For me, I am always running in and out of court, and my hair gets staticky and dry being in a courtroom all day. But thanks to my personalized pros routine, I can honestly say I've never been more in love with my hair. Pros makes custom hair care that's effective because it's personal, using natural ingredients with proven results. Pros customizes every product in your routine, from shampoo to supplements. A really neat thing is that first, Pros starts by asking about you as a person with their in-depth consultation. Pros asked me really unexpected things like, what's my zip code? What are my eating habits? What's the damage level of my hair, and even my exercise routine? Next, Pros analyzed all my answers and determined what unique blend of ingredients should be in every product of my custom hair routine. Together, Pros got all my hair goals covered. And here's the best part. If you're not 100% positive Pros is the best hair care you've had, they will take the products back, no questions asked.
Pros is the healthy hair regimen with your name all over it. Take your free in-depth hair consultation and get 15% off your first order today. Go to pros.com/prosecute. That's PROSE.com/prosecute for your free in-depth hair consultation and 15% off. Alice, growing up, cereal was always one of my favorite things to eat, and that hasn't changed. But I gotta tell you, when I was a kid, the cereal tasted a lot better. Now I feel like I gotta cut the carbs and cut out the sugar. And instead of a nice treat, cereal becomes the kind of thing you feel like you're only eating because it's healthy. But not with Magic Spoon. With Magic Spoon, a healthy breakfast doesn't have to be boring.
Brett, you're so right. Magic Spoon is a cereal with 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. That's only 140 calories a serving. And best, it's keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, and low-carb. And the variety pack has 4 flavors, which include cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter. It tastes so delicious while also being healthy. I personally love mixing the cocoa with peanut butter because it tastes exactly like a peanut butter cup.
So go to magicspoon.com/prosecute to grab a variety pack and try it today. And be sure to use our promo code PROSECUTE at checkout to save $5 off your order. And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/prosecute and use the code PROSECUTE to save $5 off. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode. Alice, before we continue, I want to talk about one of our favorite sponsors, Faraday. They've been with us for a while, and they're still with us today. You know, this is one of the most difficult times to find something to wear. Call it fake spring, call it late winter, whatever you want to call it, this is a hard time to dress. It can be so difficult to find the right outfit in the spring when every day is different and weather can change at the drop of a hat. Luckily, Faraday makes it way easier. They make the perfect clothes for all seasons. Faraday is a family-run brand making high-quality, timeless clothing with modern design and functionality. It's that kind of effortless style you want every time you go digging in your closet. That set, that shirt, that dress that feels like you've had them for years. Maybe it's in a gorgeous print and looks like it might be vintage, but it fits so well that it feels like it was made just yesterday. Just for you, well, that's Faraday.
And Brett, I'm actually wearing one of my favorite pieces from Faraday right now. It's the Haley dress. It's made from organic cotton. It doesn't wrinkle, even when I'm chasing my kids in it or going to a picnic. I love this dress, and it's incredibly flattering while still fitting my very busy and active lifestyle. And I love Faraday because they're so confident in the quality of their stuff that they have a lifetime guarantee of quality. They'll fix or replace your clothes forever, no matter what. Talk about making it easy to get dressed. And right now, Faraday is giving all of our listeners 20% off. That's 20% off. So head to FaradayBrand.com and use code TP at checkout to snag 20% off all your new spring staples. That's code TP at Faraday, FaherTyBrand.com for 20% off. Now let's talk about the grand jury findings, because we've heard so much, you know, on Twitter, on Reddit, in your emails to us, that aren't the Ramseys guilty because they went to the grand jury? And I've seen a lot of people post, and the grand jury found X, Y, and Z. They brought charges on X, Y, and Z. It just didn't go through. So I want to talk about the grand jury, because this can be a black box for a lot of people. Remember, what happens in a grand jury room is secret. There's grand jury secrecy. But what we do know is in 2013, a judge in Colorado ordered that an indictment signed by the grand jury should be unsealed. Although grand jury operations are ordinarily secret, the judge ruled that because the grand jury had prepared and signed the indictment, this represented an official action that could not remain secret, even though the DA decided not to bring charges in the case. And what the indictment revealed was strange. I'm going to read it to you. It says, on or between December 25th and December 26th, 1996, in Boulder County, Colorado, John Bennett Ramsey did unlawfully, knowingly, recklessly, and feloniously permit a child to be unreasonably placed in a situation which posed a threat of injury to the child's life or health, which resulted in the death of John Bennett Ramsey, a child under the age of 16. On or about December 25 and December 26, 1996, in Boulder County, Colorado, John Bennett Ramsey did unlawfully, knowingly, and feloniously render assistance to a person with intent to hinder, delay, and prevent the discovery, detention, apprehension, prosecution, conviction, and punishment of such person for the commission of a crime. Knowing the person being assisted has committed and was suspected of the crime of murder in the first degree and child abuse resulting in death. On or between December 25 and December 26, 1996, in Boulder County, Colorado, Patricia Poe Ramsey did unlawfully, knowingly, and recklessly and feloniously permit a child to be unreasonably placed in a situation which posed a threat of injury to the child's life or health, which resulted in the death of John Benet Ramsey, a child under the age of 16. On or about December 25 and December 26, 1996, in Boulder County, Colorado, Patricia Poe Ramsey did unlawfully, knowingly, and feloniously render assistance to a person with intent to hinder, delay, and prevent the discovery, detention, apprehension, prosecution, conviction, and punishment of such person for the commission of a crime. Knowing the person being assisted has committed and was suspected of the crime of murder in the first degree and child abuse resulting in death. Okay, I just read to you four paragraphs of an indictment. Let me summarize that for you. As you can probably tell, two of them involve John Ramsey and two of them involve Patsy Ramsey. And they are the exact same charges for both of them. And one of them is that they assisted someone covering up or a cover up, essentially. And the other one is that they permitted John Benet to be in a situation that was dangerous. Neither of them, note, is for the direct murder of John Benet. And also note, because of the theories that are around, either John or Patsy is probably who the prosecution is focusing on as the one who actually killed them. So why does the indictment not say either of them is the killer? And how can they both be charged for crimes of assisting someone else and both for putting the child in danger when neither are charged with actually killing John Benet?
This is interesting because it's sort of the worst of both worlds, right? So on the one hand, the grand jury secrecy that you're supposed to have that protects people from being tarred by the idea that a grand jury is looking into them when no charges result, we don't have that. We decided to put that aside. So now you have this out there naming John and Patsy Ramsey, and with all the negativity that comes with that. But on the other hand, because it is only this portion of the grand jury's activity that the court decided was an official action and therefore no longer subject to grand jury secrecy, in the same way that if someone's indicted, obviously, once the indictment is unsealed, that's no longer secret, right? That's no longer part of grand jury secrecy because it's an official act. Same thing here, but that's it. So we don't know really anything else that led to this. So which means not only do you have this information out there, but because you don't have more, you just have endless speculation about what exactly happened here. Now, I will tell you what I think happened here. And then, Alice, you can either agree with me or disagree with me. I think there's one thing that some people think happened, which I don't think is what happened, is that the grand jury determined that Burke was responsible for this. Burke was a minor, therefore, and not only a minor, he was nine. And in most states, a nine-year-old cannot be charged with murder, or really any crime, but certainly not murder. I think you typically have to be at least 12 to be charged with a crime like that. So he can't be charged, which means in this case, basically, the grand jury is saying that his parents helped cover it up. You know, they're probably the ones who did the garrote. And so we're going to charge him with this. That's what some people think happened here. I do not think that's what happened here, personally. I think what happened here was, and if you read Thomas's book, I think you see this coming. So Thomas's book ends before the grand jury happened because Thomas resigns in protest. He's upset with the way the investigation's going. The DA seems like they're never going to go to grand jury. They're ignoring him. They're ignoring various other experts they brought in. They refuse to use the grand jury as an investigative tool, which is unusual. You know, typically you would use the grand jury to get some people testifying in front of the grand jury so you can lock in their testimony under penalty of perjury. They don't want to do that. So he finally leaves. But the idea had been that the Boulder police, and this is weird. I mean, this is all so weird because this is not normally how it goes. Normally, a grand jury is run by the prosecution, by the DA. They are running the grand jury. They're bringing in their witnesses. They're presenting their case, and they're then asking for an indictment. In this case, the DA essentially said to the Boulder Police Department, or at least this is what it seems like from Thomas's book, you wanted a grand jury, fine. You can go in there and you can present your case to the grand jury. And that's what I think happened. I think the Boulder police, who thought that the Ramseys were responsible, went in with their evidence and presented it to the grand jury. And then I think the grand jury, on the basis of that presentation, returned this indictment, which is, to me, the perfect example of a bad indictment. Because what is happening here is the same thing in the same problem I had with Thomas's book. Thomas keeps saying, there's probable cause, we can do an arrest, let's indict these people. But what he can never definitively say is what happened and who is responsible. He thinks it's Patsy, but he can never definitively say where JonBenet was killed, how she was killed, how she ended up in the basement, who did the garrote. He can't say that. So I think the grand jury is splitting the baby here. There's a reason that both indictments of both parents read exactly the same. They don't know who did it either. They think one of them did it. So they're like, let's just indict them both for the same thing and let the trial court figure it out. And that's what they want to do. And I think the DA, there's a reason the DA refused to sanction this indictment, because he saw that this is not how you indict people. You don't indict people. You indict two people sort of in the alternative. One of them's guilty, so we'll indict them both and let them figure it out at trial. You just can't do that.
I think that's exactly right, Brett. If I were handed these two indictments, I wouldn't know what to do with it. I mean, obviously, we don't know what was actually presented to the grand jury, but if they had been given more specificity of the crime, they would have been able to bring a more specific indictment and more specific charges, and they can't do that here. And instead, these two indictments are in contradiction to each other, essentially. And it leaves out all – we face this a lot, actually, when we have a group, like a conspiracy, or we have a husband and wife, and we don't know exactly who was the one who did X, right? The one who opened that email or made the transaction because they have the same credit card, for example. And so we charge them together, but that's for like credit card transactions, not for the death of a child. And without that level of specificity, you can't go to the grand jury. Remember – sorry, can't bring that to the petite jury, to trial. All the grand jury needs to indict is probable cause. You know, that's why you have the saying, you can indict a ham sandwich. You know, hopefully that's not actually the case. And no billing a case, which means the grand jury says you do not have probable cause and we will not sign off on this indictment, does happen. But in reality, it happens pretty rarely because the bar is quite low. Now, as prosecutors, we're supposed to go to grand jury knowing we have to meet the hurdle of probable cause, but our case files have far exceeded reasonable doubt. Otherwise, we wouldn't be going to grand jury. What this sounds to me like they're doing is they're like, okay, we can barely trip over probable cause. Let's go there and hope along the way someone cracks or something in the investigation happens that it propels us to reasonable doubt. But I do not believe that when they went to the grand jury for these indictments, they had enough in their files for reasonable doubt, which is why I don't think the DA moved forward with the case.
And on Thomas's book, I listened to his book. I typically read some books and listen to some books, and that way I can read multiple books at once. And I was listening to his book on Audible. It's a really good Audible, and I actually recommend it because it really does a good job of capturing Thomas's view of things and all the problems with the case and all the problems with the DA. And one thing that Thomas says over and over and over again in that book is, we have probable cause, we have probable cause, we have probable cause. But one thing he never says, and one thing it's like he never can understand, is that's not enough. That's not enough. That's great. It's great that you got probable cause, but you don't have beyond a reasonable doubt. You just don't. And I don't think anybody thinks you've got beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't care what your theory is on this case and what you think might have happened. If you think somebody in this case is guilty beyond reasonable doubt, I would recommend you go back and reconsider what beyond a reasonable doubt means, because this case is a complete mess. And even this grand jury, you can tell they don't know who did it, even if they think they basically accept it was someone in the family. That's their theory. Somebody in the family, not sure who. You know, this is not a conspiracy. They don't charge the two parents with conspiring. They don't even charge them with aiding and abetting a specific person. They don't say, you know, John Ramsey, aiding and abetting his wife, Patsy Ramsey, or whatever. They don't do that. They just charge this sort of very vague thing, like they were somehow involved, not really sure how. And that's why this didn't go through. It's not because, as Thomas often claims, that the DA is just so biased and they were in the pocket of the Ramseys the whole time. I mean, maybe they were, but objectively speaking, they made the right decision not to attempt to go forward with this. I don't even know how you would present this case to a jury. I mean, you can't just show up and say, well, somebody did it and it was probably one of them, so you guys pick which one you think is guilty. Like, that's never going to work. They never even would have made it to a jury. They would have gotten ran out of the courthouse if they had tried to bring this indictment to trial.
And, you know, we don't know the politics behind it. Obviously, this case got immense press as soon as it happened. The nation was following this, and there was probably so much internal politics and infighting, all wanting the same thing, right? Everyone wants this case solved. Everyone wants there to be justice for JonBenet. And presenting this type of indictment to the grand jury may have been the result of some convoluted infighting, may have been the result of feeling pressure from the public. You know, we don't know all the decisions that go into this, and typically those shouldn't affect how you proceed in the grand jury and how you proceed with prosecuting a case. But the reality is, this is not a case like any other. This truly was a case in a class of its own because of the media frenzy around it, even at the time. Prosecutors and grand jurors are normal people who have feelings. When you guys leave really negative reviews about us, it kind of hurts our feelings. When people say mean things about us in court, we have to be professional, but we're humans. We have feelings. And it is difficult to see how anyone working on this case could shut out the immense attention that was being focused on them. So it may just be they stumbled towards the grand jury with this imperfect indictment because at least they were doing something.
I think there was a lot of pressure on the Boulder DA to at least have a grand jury. It's interesting, you will occasionally see a grand jury that is held specifically for the purpose of no-billing a case. One case where you saw that, you guys might remember back in 2014, Michael Brown, who was an African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri. It led to a lot of unrest. There were some riots. But afterwards, there was a lot of information that came out that indicated that the police officer who was involved might have been justified in using his weapon in that case. And what happened, a grand jury was called. The prosecution sort of put on its case about what happened. But then at the conclusion of the grand jury, actually recommended to the grand jury that they no-bill, which means that they not return an indictment against the police officer in the case. And the idea was, we're going to present this to a grand jury. At the end of the day, the grand jury will decide, but we as the prosecutors are saying, we don't think there's a case here. And the grand jury did return a no-bill in that case. And that happens in very rare instances. In this case, I think you have something in the middle. I think you had a prosecution that went in that was not asking for a no bill, but they weren't asking for a bill either. They weren't asking for a true bill, which is what you call it when someone's indicted. They kind of just left it to the police, which, like I said, is very weird. It's a very strange thing. And I think the police really did come in and present kind of the story that you see in Thomas's book, that, you know, in their perspective, there's no evidence of an intruder. There's some circumstantial evidence. You know, there's Patsy wearing the same clothes. There's the fiber evidence. There's the perceived unusual activity by the parents, the fact that they won't talk to the police, just all the things that you've heard about. And those were the things they presented to this jury. And I think the grand jury, like Alice said, there's a lot of emotion. People want to do something. They don't want this young girl to die, to be murdered, and no one ever be held responsible. So if the police are coming in and saying to you, look, it was one of the parents, not sure which one, but it was one of them, an indictment that's basically they did it together somehow is really attractive, I think, to a lay person, which is what a grand jury is. I mean, grand jurors are just like everybody else. They're just regular people off the street. And I think that's why it was attractive to them. But I think once the DA got that, a DA who was already really hesitant to bring any charges against the Ramseys in this case, once they saw that, they're just like, no, we can't do this. And they sort of expected, we'll just say no, this will go away, and nobody will ever know. And then years later, you have this judge who says, nope, we're going to let that be public after all. That brings us to really one of the most important things that happened in this case that we've, you know, we've spent now 8 episodes talking about this case, and we haven't talked about the DNA in this case. And this is a really critical part of all of this that people really debate. And so we wanted to kind of dive into this a little bit. And it all starts really in 2009. So Alex Hunter had been the DA when JonBenet Ramsey was killed. He had been the DA who oversaw the investigation. Well, at some point, after serving as DA for like 30 years, he was the king of Boulder, which was another reason the police didn't like him, because he was the king of Boulder, but he wasn't as eager as the police, perhaps, to enforce some of the laws. But at some point, he steps down, and a new DA takes over. Her name is Mary Lacey. And as we're going to talk about, she got some evidence which led her to decide to publicly exonerate the Ramseys. And here, there's a long letter that she wrote about this. You can find it and read the whole thing if you want to, but I'll read a paragraph for you, which I think sort of encapsulates the entirety of what she said. For reasons including those discussed above, we believe that justice dictates that the Ramseys be treated only as victims of this very serious crime. We will accord them all the rights guaranteed to the victims of violent crimes under the law in Colorado, and all the respect and sympathy due from one human being to another. To the extent that this office has added to the distress suffered by the Ramsey family at any time or to any degree, I offer my deepest apology. Now, this is completely different from what the DA had said at the beginning when they talked about the Ramseys being under an umbrella of suspicion. Now they're not under suspicion anymore. They get an apology from the DA. They're treated only as victims. They are not suspects at all in the eyes of the Boulder Police Department. And one of the real bases for this decision was some new DNA evidence.
Yeah, Brett, this is huge. They aren't just saying they're no longer suspects. They're saying they are exonerated. That's a huge step forward. Of course, this isn't like the Cosby case. I don't think they're saying we'll never prosecute you, because obviously if they get new information, they'll change their tactic. But to publicly say, not only are you no longer suspects, but we're going to clear your name, is something you hardly ever see. And I'm surprised they took the step, to be honest, but I guess I'm glad they did it if they felt so strong within their investigation. Because remember, you don't have to show anything of your deliberative process as the prosecution. Even if they had exonerating evidence, they didn't have to say anything about it, right? But they chose to do this.
Yeah, and I think the fact that they chose to do it, this decision's been widely criticized by people who think the Ramseys are involved, but the fact they chose to do it says a lot to me, because they didn't have to do it. 10 years. This is 10 years after the murder. More than 10 years. 11 years after the murder. And I don't know. I mean, to me, it's pretty significant. But you can debate whether or not they should have done it. And I think you have to start that debate with the DNA evidence itself.
The DNA testing was done on JonBenet's clothes in 1997 and 2008. Remember, we've talked about how DNA evidence and science kind of develop so quickly that even in the span of 10 years, new technologies can come. And if you still have the DNA, you can retest it. And this is why it's important to not use up all your DNA in case, and by use up all your DNA, as we've said earlier, when you test DNA, it quite literally uses up the DNA and it no longer exists. So there is a finite number of times you can test DNA before it's all burned up, so to speak. Now, in 1997, the testing found that the blood stains in JonBenet's underwear were from her, and that there was a third-party DNA profile mixed in with her DNA. At the time, the testing was not able to do much with this third-party sample, and so they sat on it. All they could tell was it's a third party. But in 2008, new DNA testing was ordered with new technology, and Bode Technology tested four different areas of JonBenet's, quote, white long underwear bottoms at the waistband. This was the exterior top right half of long johns, exterior top left half of long johns, the interior top right half of long johns, interior top left half of long johns, and on the exterior top right half of long johns, they found, quote, contains a mixture of at least two individuals, including the victim, and at least one male contributor. It excludes DNA from Burke, Patsy, John, Melinda, and John Andrew Ramsey. Bode then compared the two, and the results were interesting to say the least. Bode found, quote, notably, the profile developed by the Denver PD and previously uploaded to the CODIS database as a forensic unknown profile, and the profiles developed from the exterior top right and left portions of the long johns were consistent.
This is really important. And honestly, I feel like people often underplay how important this is. We have talked about, and a lot of people talk about, the DNA that was found in JonBenet's underwear and how it is a third party and how it is not a match for any of the members of the family. And some people have said, well, you know, maybe it's just random DNA. Maybe it's DNA from the manufacturer. Maybe it's the DNA from somebody who put the underwear in the packaging. Could be a DNA from any number of people. And sort of the argument is, see, it could be anybody, so therefore it doesn't mean anything. Now, I just want to start off by saying that is a fallacy. It certainly may be the case that the DNA comes from a third party. But when you find DNA, and by third party I mean an uninvolved third party, that could happen. But you can't just ignore it. And I feel like people who believe the Ramseys are involved, this DNA evidence, they looked at it and they said, well, maybe it was from the manufacturer. Yeah, it was probably that. Worthless. Junk. Not even going to worry about it. It reminds me, Alice, did you ever see House? Did you ever watch the show House?
I've seen episodes, but I didn't watch all of it.
So there was an episode fairly early on in the run of House that always stuck with me. You know, House's thing was everybody lies. And so he's always trying to figure out who was lying. And this couple comes in and they have herpes. Both of them have herpes. And they don't know how they got it, right? So House's theory is that one of them is having an affair. And so they come in and they're really upset about this and they're trying to figure out how this happened. And House says, well, you know, sometimes if you sit down in a public toilet, you can get herpes that way. And the husband says, oh, I bet that's how it happened. And the wife's like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. What are you talking about? And House immediately says, he did it. He was the one having the affair. Because when given this, like, you know, limb, this barest reed to grasp onto, he'd immediately jumped on it. Whereas the wife is like, no, that doesn't make any sense. And in a way, that's kind of confirmation bias, you know, in action. Because you have the wife who's actually looking at it critically and not accepting whatever would fit her theory. And then you have the husband who really needs a theory other than I was having an affair. And as soon as he gets it, he grabs onto it. I feel like the same thing here. People who want the Ramseys to be involved need this DNA to be relevant. So they grab onto the possibility that it's random DNA. Random DNA happens, and it could be random, but you can't ignore it, and you really can't ignore it after this 2008 testing, because what happens is this company looks not at the DNA that was in the underwear, but the DNA that was on the waistband of these long johns that JonBenet was wearing, and they find DNA that is consistent with the DNA in the underwear. And it is not the case, and it is basically impossible to believe that the random, uninvolved third party would leave DNA in both places. If there's DNA that is the same, that's in the underwear and that's on the waistband, then that is almost certainly from someone who was involved in the crime, and that DNA doesn't fit any of the family members, and that's huge. Now, here's one caveat. It's not the same. It's consistent. We've talked about this before, and we've talked about DNA before, and DNA is not magic. So we don't have great DNA samples here. If, as I recall, I think there are 13 markers in the sample from the underwear and 10 from the waistband. There's enough overlap that it's consistent, which means you have overlapping markers, which lead the DNA folks to think this is consistent, likely the same, but they can't say for certain because they don't have the complete sequence. If they had the complete sequence, they could say for certain that it's the same within, you know, 1 in 50 trillion or whatever. They can't say that here. They don't give us a number, so we can't say exactly what it is. But the fact that you have consistent DNA in these two places, these very sensitive places, in a murder that likely involved a sexual assault, means that that is really powerful physical evidence for this being an intruder.
Certainly. And just so you know, whenever we've talked about this, whenever we present DNA evidence in court, that's the language you use. Consistent with, or 99% probability that it matches the profile. It's never, this is Brett or this is Alice. That's not how DNA is read. So just know that while this language may sound strange to you, this is the type of verbiage you use when describing DNA evidence. And Brett, to have ruled out the family, you're right, is huge, is absolutely huge, because not only is the family's DNA not on the underwear, but it indicates that they are not around or aware of who this third person is when they are leaving this DNA on JonBenet's underwear as well. Otherwise, their DNA may be in the mix.
And you have some real grasping at straws that you'll see people do when confronted with this. I mean, one theory I read was that Patsy accidentally kills JonBenet and then calls somebody from outside the home who's like a friend, an acquaintance, who comes over and helps her stage the murder. And that person is the third party. This is where the third party DNA is from. So it's still Patsy, but there is a third party who comes in to help her cover it up. That didn't happen. I'll just go ahead and tell you. That is not what happened here. Patsy did not have an outside accomplice. That did not happen. And when you're having to sort of grasp at straws like that, I think it says a lot about, you need to take a step back, because it's possible that your underlying theory isn't correct. We talk about confirmation bias a lot, and when you see this evidence that sort of rams up against what you think, you really have to take a hard look at it. Now look, it is possible that this is complete junk. It's possible that if they'd had 11 markers on the waistband, that they would have been able to say, these are actually not consistent. They're from two different people. Doesn't matter. Nevertheless, given what they have, it is powerful evidence. Now, DNA, people think DNA is the be-all, end-all. It gets twisted all the time. And we've talked about how there's DNA everywhere, just like there's fingerprints everywhere. I remember there was a case not too long ago of a person who had been executed. I think it was in Arkansas. They'd been executed, and there was this New York Times story that was like, the headline was, you know, man was executed for murder. Then they found someone else's DNA on the murder weapon. And it was something like, I think he had beaten his victim to death, maybe with a bat. And then on the bat, they had found some DNA that they couldn't tie to anybody. And so that was where the headline came from. Now, if you read the story, you would have known that in addition to that testing, they were able for the first time to test the blood that had been on the accused shoes. And at the time, they were not able to tie the blood to anybody, but with this new technology, they had tested it, and it was consistent with the victim. To me, finding blood consistent with the victim was far more powerful than finding random DNA that was not consistent with the accused on the murder weapon, because that was probably just random DNA, whereas the blood of the victim wasn't random. And here, I think you have a similar thing. If you only had DNA in the underwear, or if you only had DNA on the waistband, then it's evidence, and maybe it points somewhat to a third party, but it's not that strong. And you can say things like, could be the manufacturer, could just be some random person who happened to touch the waistband of the clothes. But once you have that consistency between the two places, then that is much stronger. And you have to work to get past that.
Wow. I know people are going to have a lot of thoughts about this episode, Brett. We've talked about grand jury, DNA. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And guys, guess what? We really have reached the part of our outline about theories. But that's going to be next time.
That's right. Next episode, the last episode, episode 9, will be all theories. And we're going to have an entire episode to talk about the theories in this case and really dive into them and dive into how the evidence that we've talked about up to this point fits with the various theories that people have and the various suspects that people have. Really interested to hear what you guys think about what we've talked about so far. If you love this case, I'm sorry that it's coming to an end. If you hate this case, congratulations. In a mere 2 weeks, we'll be on a new case. But for now, if you have thoughts, reach out to us, prosecutorspod@gmail.com, @prosecutorspod for Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Check us out on Reddit. Join the Patreon if you're sick of ads. Go to the gallery on Facebook where they are having a lot of awesome discussions on this case. I've learned a lot. You'll learn a lot, too. Hey guys, we are going to CrimeCon. CrimeCon is in May this year, hopefully, if the creeks don't rise and various other things. I thought I was going to CrimeCon last year and didn't quite make it, but this year we're going to do our best. It's in Vegas. We hope you guys will join us. If you haven't signed up yet and you want to go to CrimeCon, use code PROSECUTORS for 10% off. We really want to see you guys. We went down to Savannah last year and had a blast meeting people. Alice went to CrimeCon in Austin last year, and I know she had a lot of fun there. We love seeing you guys. We love putting faces with names. So I hope that as many of you as possible will try and join us.
Join us. We missed you so much last year, Brett, but I promised everyone last year that you would definitely make it this year, and I think we're going to make good on that promise.
I love Vegas. We'll get a craps table together and play all night long. I can't wait. Okay, guys, well, that's all we have for this week, but we'll be back next week with the final episode in the JonBenet Ramsey investigation. Finally, find out what our theories are and which theory we think best fits the evidence. But until then, I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the prosecutors. Justin Bieber just bought an NFT ape for $1 million.
What's an NFT? I'm sorry. I mean, you don't have to answer that. I have no idea what that means.
It's the token, the non-fungible tokens. Don't.
You've tried to explain this to me one time, and this is why I'll never be rich, because I don't understand that at all.
It's one of those things where if you'd gotten into it a year ago, you'd have made $1 million. Now if you get into it, you just lose all the
money.
Kind of like how I said, you know, don't buy Dogecoin, and everybody got mad at me, and Dogecoin crashed. So, Don't buy the Bored Ape NFT. It's going to crash. Just right-click on it and copy it. You'll own one, and you can say, look, I have a Bored Ape. That's great. Sorry, I digress. Okay. So you ready to start?
Yeah, clear that money maker.
Watch Yellowstone for free on Pluto TV. All this weekend, Pluto TV is streaming a marathon of seasons 1 to 3 of Yellowstone, the show the rap calls a smash hit series. Pluto TV also has hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and TV shows like Mission Impossible 3, Gladiator, CSI, and more. Absolutely free. So download the free Pluto TV streaming app and watch Yellowstone seasons 1 to 3 free.